The room probably sounds more echoey than the past few episodes. That's because I'm recording in what's known as the Archive It meeting room at the Internet Archive before the workday, 8 a.m., here in San Francisco, California, in 2017. I've always wanted to live in California. I work here now, so I spend more time per year than I ever have in my life. It is a dream come true. I thought I'd talk a little bit about that dream. This is Jason Scott. You're listening to Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. A big thanks to Daniel Boyd, Jeff Atwood, and everyone else who has been supporting this podcast, which I'm using to pay off some debts. So I wasn't born anywhere near California. I was born in Poughkeepsie, New York. We moved immediately to Hopewell Junction, New York. I then lived in East Fishkill, New York, Brewster, New York, Chappaqua, New York. I was definitely a New York kid, my accent shows it, and I somehow fell in love with California. Now, I can actually tell you exactly why I fell in love with California. That's because of Atari. Atari was this major influence in my life. Not just the idea of games and computers and all of these different technological marvels in my local arcade, but somehow the company itself pushed a kind of California aesthetic, whether it was the artwork or the fact that it would say Sunnyvale, California, which sounded like a mystical and wonderful place. I just knew that California was the place that I could be myself in a way that maybe I felt I couldn't somewhere in the New York area. California seemed like the ultimate destination for a kid like me, with dreams that were wrapped among technology and creation and using programming and artwork on the pixel level to express himself. I was definitely thinking that as soon as I came of age, I'd pack up my car and my bags and just head out west. Didn't work out that way. But it was something that was so kind of ingrained into my childhood, I can't think of any part of it that wasn't in some way influenced by this dream. I loved California companies. I loved companies that would say that they were doing computer work, you know, and that they were somewhere in the Silicon Valley, the San Fernando Valley. I'd have these names in my mind like San Jose and San Francisco and Sacramento, and I just thought that was where I'd end up. So I ended up going to California a couple times in my life before I started coming regularly here for the Internet Archive. Let me talk a little bit about those. So my father, who had partial custody of his three kids, had a really fun idea. Let's take the kids on a big trip. And to do it, he told us all that we were going to California, which, again, for me, was like finding out I was finally going home. He told us we'd be staying with cousins, cousins who were a little more distant, who I had heard of, but I'd never really met. And I was kind of excited about that too, in the way one is initially excited about meeting family. So he loaded us up into an Eastern Airlines plane, and we went to California. Now here's the thing. When we landed, I knew that all of my dreams were correct. I loved the weather, I loved the plants, I loved the look of the architecture. I remember having this very strong impression in my mind of, this environment causes creativity. Like I felt a crackling in my mind from all of the potential things that could be done. I was marveling at, I would just walk around in this bright sunshine and create things. This really meant a lot to me. I didn't like winters. I didn't like sweltery summers. I liked what they had there in California. So we were staying with the family, and they had a lemon tree, which was a mind blower to me at the time. I didn't know lemons came from trees. I certainly didn't know that regular folks could have a tree with lemons in it. And then my father dropped the terrible news on us, which was that this California stop was just a pit stop, and that actually we were going to Hawaii. Now, I know for most people, that'd be great news, but for me, it meant I wasn't going to stay in California, I wasn't going to see what was there, I was going to some dumb old island. So we actually went to Hawaii a couple days later, and it was okay. Hawaii, even back then, was pretty much a big tourist trap to me. I almost died on a reef, which was a story in itself, And I basically just sat around going, yep, it's nice. The mountain is nice. The beaches are nice. But this ain't no California. Now, while we were in California, though, my father did drive us around. And he and I have had a chat about this particular memory. And it's actually kind of a lesson in how memories are kind of built from your childhood. What I specifically remember is that we were driving along, and suddenly, to my great surprise, was one of the Apple buildings. In fact, it was one of the earliest Apple buildings. This was 1981, and there was the Apple logo on a big square. And if you ever saw the articles on Apple back then, there's one of Steve Jobs standing on top of this particular box, this Apple logo box. So I got super agitated. I told my father, please pull over, pull over. And we got a picture of me wearing my cool sunglasses, leaning up against the Apple logo. Now, in my memory, I was the genius who reached out and said, do it, pull over. But my father later explained to me that he had intentionally figured out where Apple was, and he had driven by like it was no big deal. In fact, he may have been the one who pointed it out to me. So each of us have walked away being the hero in the story, and I don't think any harm has come of it, but there you go. In my early 20s, which is the 1990s, I had this great idea to fly out to California to spend time with a girl I'd met online. She'd flown to Boston to see me, and I thought it only right to fly back to see her. So, using my newly minted credit cards, I paid something ridiculous. It probably was $600 or $700 to fly across the country and spend a couple weeks with her. It didn't go as well as it could. We had some fun, but not great fun. Neither of us drove, so we didn't go anywhere outside of Santa Cruz. And what I do remember was I spent 4 or 5 years paying back that credit. I should have known back then that I had some sort of a problem and should have sought more information about how to take care of my finances. I think if I look back, that's the first real warning sign that credit was not for me. But what I do remember, again, about Santa Cruz was that the fog was amazing, rolling over the hills, coming out to Santa Cruz. I remember visiting the boardwalk. I remember the heat, the interesting architecture of the homes. I had a great time. It was primarily focused around this online relationship, but it was definitely, once again, affirmation for me that California was a special place. You'd think by then I probably would have taken the big leap to go there, but I just wasn't built that way. I was definitely living in Boston, being a Boston person. Somehow it didn't occur to me that, like, there was another way to go. Nowadays, when I give advice to people, and believe it or not, people come to me for life advice, you know, I definitely push for it. Take a risk. Take a leap. Leave your stuff with relatives. Go for it. Life's too short not to take a shot in the dark. You'd be surprised how much of a support network you have in terms of trying something new. And if you're not grandiose about your own needs, that is to say, you feel that you need to have this amount of stuff with you or that you need to spend this amount of money, you can do some mind-blowing things out there. But when I started to really understand California, I think, was around 2000, 2001. And what had happened was I was working for a company called Digital Island. This was a company that was locked dead step into the entire dot-com boom. It was originally started by Hawaiians to bridge the Pacific-American gap in telecommunications. So it was easiest to send fiber through the Pacific from Japan over to Hawaii, and then from Hawaii out to the west coast of the United States. And so this Hawaiian company had kind of built up providing this sort of link. As was the case a lot of times in this period. They got a lot of investment. They started to build up their reputation, and they started to buy other companies until Digital Island purchased the company that I was part of and was building an empire of data centers. Now, somewhere in the middle of all that, there was this attempt, I guess, to put everybody in one place to teach them. It's one of those ideas that sounds really great on paper, but then you start to think about it and you're like, why did you fly everybody from around the country just to shove them in a room? But they did it. And I remember my coworker, Scott, and I were flown from Boston to San Francisco to attend a multi-day seminar for the company. Now, what I remember most about that entire time was that, well, first of all, I was being sued for $120,000. I was being sued by my previous company, who officially were trying to stop a rogue employee from taking down their network, but which unofficially I knew was desperately trying to keep me quiet with a slap lawsuit to stop them from having any affectation of their IPO, which was based on fraudulent ideas. Anyway, here we are in San Francisco, working for another company that has kind of puffed itself up and is maybe going beyond its means. And Scott and I are in this room. I'm answering calls from the Boston Globe for the lawsuit thing, so I'm out in the hallway a lot. It was a wharf building that you could see the Bay Bridge from, and it was on a nice boardwalk area. It was a nice meeting spot. And Scott and I were in there, and it didn't take us long to figure out that this was a meeting by and for salesmen. I have very complicated feelings about salesmen. I say salesmen and not salespeople because I just encounter this unbelievable testosterone-filled torrent of miserable need to express yourself as being one better than everyone else. And the late 1990s and early 2000s gave rise to a breed of salesmen that was particularly toxic because sales were easy. You know, I have respect for a certain kind of person. There's a mentor of mine, Clive Smith. Clive told me that one of his greatest joys was cold calling, the experience where you call someone on the phone who you have no previous connection to and walking away with a sale. He loved that hunt, that push, that attempt to grab someone's mind with an idea and explain to them that they needed something more than anything else before you came along to save them from this fate. Clive was amazing. I still use lessons Clive taught me across the years in my daily life. But these folks were not Clive Smith. These were people who had already sold the product before they even walked in the door. The most work they had to do was to make sure all the right people signed on the bottom line. That was it. They weren't really fighters. They didn't change up their game. They didn't shift and parry and listen to your words and change them around so that you became the person who was asking instead of them asking. And they acted like they were the heroes of the Middle Earth, saving us from destiny and danger. Anyway, so we were stuck in a room with these people. It was just a bunch of sloganeering and self-aggrandizement. And very quickly, Scott and I figured that as two Unix admins, we had nothing to provide here. So I remember we just said, let's go for a walk. What is San Francisco like these days? So one day we just walked. We walked, we went out from the pier, we went towards the hills. We found a staircase that led up what seemed like forever. So we walked up it. It led us to a hill. We walked up the hill. It had murals and beautiful little homes. We looked at them and kept walking. And eventually Scott and I found ourselves at Coit Tower, which is this beautifully made, unique tower on one part of the city, which had all sorts of inscriptions and people walking around. I just remember that being really magical. Additionally, we kind of walked around the parts of the city that had those weird signs from all these dot-coms who put up bigger and better signs to indicate that their dumb company was more important than the other dumb companies that had websites. And somehow this was supposed to be the new generation of how business would be. I dipped my hands into this pool of ridiculousness and luxuriant foolishness. I'm glad I got to witness it, but I am also glad that I wasn't living out there at the time. During the time of the BBS documentary filming, I went out to California a number of times. I went out there to film members of the Acid and Ice ANSI groups. I went out there to interview people who had created all sorts of technology in the 70s and the 80s. I mean, I met some really awesome folks. They all had interesting stories. But what I'll always remember was to do the filming of ICE and ACID members meeting. We were in a building that one of the members was kind of working in. And this was the downside of the boom. This was the dot bust. This was when things were starting to go south. And I was in a building that had been owned by a different group that had gone out of business. They were leasing out the rest of the time on their lease to another company that was just using the space. So it was one of these cases where I'm walking among the detritus of another company's ridiculous dream. I remember a couple things from this. First, they had really dumb seats that were some kind of plastic and cloth piece that you could sit on and they rolled a little bit. It was explained to me that these were made for a couple $1,000s a piece. Additionally, there was a light table. Now, normally, light tables are just this boring box with light underneath it that enables you to look at transparencies and other such items with ease. It's not an important tool. Obviously, this company figured out that they needed it to be an important tool. So they had, I swear to God, a 20 or 30 foot light table. It was explained to me that it was tens of thousands of dollars to build this light table. Why? Why? I'm worried, really, that people are going to look back at the excesses of the dot-com era and think that it was a good idea or that it was just one or two minor mistakes. There was a mania of waste that was unprecedented. I don't even think we can do it now to that level. The idea of not just buying a monitor, but buying the most expensive, unique, calibrated monitor, and then handing it to every member of your company, regardless of if they did exacting design work or if they basically typed on a command line. The idea that you wouldn't just have a chair, but you would give everyone the most expensive engineered chair available on the market by brand name, bar none, for everybody. The waste was epic. And interviewing these guys about ANSI art in this realm of weird chairs and expensive tables and a space that was now half empty and darkened just really struck home for me how I had missed personally a bullet. I mean, yes, I'd worked for a company that was affected by the dot-com, but then they went off and got sold to another company, and I still continued to work for another 10 years at the company before I was laid off. The California that I had dreamed about as a youth had reached a peak of some sort, and I was both happy that I had missed this bullet and sad that I didn't know about the wonder that had come before on a personal level. So when I joined the Internet Archive, initially I was just happy to be here and to have the freedom to work on the archiving projects I'd always wanted to be able to reach out to people and offer them space and bandwidth far beyond what they were able to get themselves. I mean, I love my job. We've already covered that. But what I also love is that multiple times in the year, I fly out to California to work on things locally. This last week, if you were tracking my life, you saw that I performed at the yearly Internet Archive event, where I dressed up in multiple outfits and talked about our software emulation, and also was part of a larger discussion about the things the archive is working on. And if you didn't, please, I suggest you look at it. There's one sequence where we talk about rescuing an old film of a Japanese internment camp in the 1940s, and then we had a resident of that camp come up from the audience and tell his story over the film we were showing. It was a very special moment. I was glad to be part of it. I also spent time over at the Internet Archive's physical archive, where I have crates upon crates of software. I'm here for another week where I'll be doing more work in the physical archive, as well as meeting my coworkers and talking about plans. But what I really love about this place is that I'm able to rent a car and drive. And I go all over the place when I'm here. I love going up and down 280, which is one of the most beautiful highways you could imagine. I took some friends to Santa Cruz over the weekend. We drove down Highway 1, stopped over in Davenport and had some delicious pumpkin pie, went all the way down to Santa Cruz, went on the boardwalk, and then up here, I was able to visit Sausalito and the houseboats. I mean, California is still a magical place to me, even in my 40s. I'm glad I lived long enough to make it a regular part of my life. I'm glad I'm out here for such a good cause, to work with a nonprofit that's trying to bring as much information to as many people as often as possible, to make us a better place to live, both in California and the rest of the world. Well, it's time to start my work day. I look forward to ripping a bunch of CDs, answering a bunch of emails, and generally living my own personal dream. A dream that you're helping with the Patreon of this podcast. Especially thanks to James Bakoyanu, Sam Johnston, Astrid Smith, Kevin Waters, but also the hundreds of other people who are contributing to this Patreon and making my life debt-free. This is Jason Scott. You've been listening to Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. See you next week in beautiful New York.